25. What I ask is simple enough. You have access to your own memories from the past 3,000 years.
As well as all the written records that have been digitized.
It's your own memories I need. You were in Ender's ear for most of his life, seeing all he saw, hearing all he heard.
And hearing whichever of his thoughts he chose to share with me.
To write the final document of my speaking of his death.
You want to write the life of Ender to stand parallel with the Hive Queen and the Hegemon and the life of human.
Doesn't he deserve such treatment? More than his brother ever did.
But he deserves as good a speaker as the writer of those works, and you are not qualified.
I know. But with your help, with your memories and perceptions, I can come closer than I can without.
So I should help you make a project that is a botch from its conception into somewhat less of a botch?
Yes. It's all that's within my reach, and nobody else is reaching. Memorandum of Conversation, Jane and Pleaked. From Pleaked, Notes on the Life of Ender.
Please let me come with you, said Thulium. Wang Mu looked at her carefully. Was she sincere? Or had she merely improved her ability to pretend to be a caring, sensitive person? So much evidence pointed both ways. We can't stop you from coming, said Peter, so why ask?
I want to be part of the conversation, said Thulium.
So talk whenever you want, said Peter. We'll listen.
I want to be a respected part of the conversation.
Well, that will depend on what you say, said Peter.
Wang Mu knew it was time to intervene. Thulium, I know you think we cheated when we went to the surface of Nest without you. I was offended and hurt and angry, yes, said Thulium. But by the time you got back, and definitely after that, I realized that it would have been crazy for me and Sprout to go at the same time. You would have had to think about protecting us the whole time.
What has changed? Asked Wang Mu.
I've grown up a little. Not just smarter, but wiser too. I almost died from the bioweapon of the folk, which hit me hardest because of my own stupidity in going first and going alone.
This is all good news, said Wang Mu. But it doesn't explain why you want to go with us.
The Kias are insane, said Thulium. If I go to them alone, I'll be lucky if I get treated as mildly as Sprout did.
Kia poop is a good thing to avoid, said Peter.
But you have a friend among the Kia, a friend who seems to be a leader. Are you going to the world where Royal Sun is living?
Yes, said Wang Mu.
Please let me meet him and his tribe under your protection.
Wang Mu knew what was really happening. Though Thulium treated her Aunt Carlotta as a kind of foster mother, Carlotta couldn't be her mother in all the ways that Thulium needed. In other cultures, and other eras, mothers would introduce their daughters in society, giving them standing and asserting protection. Thulium was asking Wang Mu to be her sponsor with another species, and for Peter to be her protection, though Wang Mu knew Royal Sun's relationship was primarily with her. But it was more than that. Peter had been the one assigned to love her, back when they thought Peter would be the one helping her detour. But what happened, inadvertently, was the development of a far greater philotic bond between Wang Mu and Thulium.
With me, she not only feels safe, she feels known.
Peter, said Wang Mu, what if Thulium stays with me
and only contributes to a conversation when I tell her it's all right?
She won't abide by any such rules, said Peter.
I know why you believe that, said Thulium, but...
This is a conversation, said Peter, between Wang Mu and me, between husband and wife, deciding whether to take a child into a conversation which he has not earned a place in. This is not a time for you to plead your own case.
Wang Mu smiled at Thulium to soften Peter's words.
Wang Mu is speaking for you, said Peter, far better than you could possibly speak for yourself.
Wang Mu could see that Thulium already had a retort in her mind, in her mouth, ready to be spoken. But she did not speak. If she makes a mistake, my love, said Wang Mu to Peter, let me smooth over any misunderstanding. I believe I will be able to do it, though I think it will never be necessary.
Royal Sun and all the other Kias will wonder why we brought her, what her purpose is, said Peter.
Wang Mu took a few steps to the bassinet where baby Feizi was sleeping. She picked up the baby carefully, not waking him, and handed him to Thulium.
At first, Thulium shrank back. When would she have ever handled a baby in her life?
But then she understood, if not everything, then something, and she reached out and took the baby from Wang Mu.
This time, finding himself in unfamiliar hands that did not hold him in familiar ways, he woke up and began to whimper softly.
What am I doing wrong? Asked Thulium. Absolutely nothing, except for the horrible mistake of not being me or Peter, said Wang Mu. Well, I plead guilty to that. Rock slightly back and forth. It's a pattern all parents learn, and while it doesn't always work, it improves your chances, said Wang Mu.
It worked for me,
said Peter, getting into the spirit of this. Wang Mu knew that Peter recognized that she was determined to bring Thulium, and he would join her in trusting Thulium with the care of their little boy in order to bring it off. Within a half hour, Thulium had been taught and had practiced feeding the baby, changing his diaper, singing softly to him, and getting him back to sleep. I'm obviously not an expert, said Thulium. Stay with me and help me with the baby for a few days before we go.
Peter did not remind her that they had planned to leave today, after lunch.
Thulium agreed.
So it was that when Jane led them for the first time to the continent where Kias lived, Thulium was with Peter, Wang Mu, and little Feizi, holding on to the backpack that held the supplies for the baby.
Where are the Kias? Peter asked Jane.
This is the continent where they live, said Jane. I didn't stay to see where they built their nests.
But they could be anywhere, said Peter. How big is this continent?
The size of Africa, back on Earth, said Jane.
How are we supposed to find them? Asked Peter.
By looking in the right places, said Jane. All three of you are very smart.
Figure it out.
And with that, Jane was gone.
They were on fairly level ground. There were mountains visible in the distance, though with clouds gathered along the peaks, it was hard for Wang Mu to decide whether the mountains were snow-capped or not.
What do we know about Kias? She asked.
They were the only alpine parrots on Earth, said Peter. They lived in the mountains and high forests of the South Island of New Zealand. They must have flown there as ordinary parrots, and then became Kias on that island.
So, should we look in the mountains? Asked Wang Mu.
Well-watered mountains, I imagine, said Peter. Forests need water.
There hasn't been time for any earth flora to take over anywhere. So are we even sure what a forest will look like here? Asked Wang Mu. The vegetation will be thick and lush, said Thulium. If there are no predators, the kias will nest on the ground. If there are trees with strong wooden branches, they'll nest in the trees.
Wang Mu saw Peter looking at Thulium for a moment before he said, So, how do we go about finding such a location? I don't want to try doing aerial reconnaissance, because I'm not Jane, and we don't have the box.
We could try reasoning, said Wang Mu.
We know nothing about this planet, said Peter.
We know that Jane didn't take us to the Arctic or Antarctic zones, said Thulium. The sun is fairly low in that direction, and I'll assume, because it isn't very hot, that it's still early in the morning.
Well, that's something, said Peter.
Judging from the trajectory of the sun, Thulium continued, we're near the equator. I think we'll find that at noon, our shadows pool around our feet.
So, this continent straddles the equator, said Peter. And that's about where we are.
This is a grassy plain, but it isn't yet in seed, and the kias evolved in a more deciduous environment at a high elevation, said Thulium. So perhaps we should simply move either north or south until we find mountains and forests. At this latitude, we're likely to find only jungles, grasslands, or deserts.
Wang Mu looked at Peter and smiled.
Good advice is good advice, she said.
Would you like me or Wang Mu to lead the way? Asked Peter.
What if I take you with me? Asked Thulium.
No, said Peter. You will take the backpack with you. Wang Mu or I will hold the baby in its wrap. And whichever of us doesn't have the baby, that's the one that leads. That's plenty for any of us to keep in our minds while detouring.
Wang Mu could see that an argument had already leapt to Thulium's mind, but the girl held her tongue, and Wang Mu was pleased. The baby is the most important, said Thulium mildly. But the diapers, wipes, and food and drink for him will make this trip much easier. Thank you for trusting me with that.
Wang Mu, said Peter, you have the baby, so I'll explore ahead first.
Me first, said Wang Mu, and, still holding the baby in the wrap, she leapt. As soon as Wang Mu arrived, she walked up a rise of ground and saw that there was no apparent danger nearby. She turned back and could barely see the others in the distance.
Prairie land like this was convenient, but as soon as they reached trees, beckoning wouldn't work. But it could work now, so she waved, and then beckoned. A moment later, Thulium was there, with all the supplies.
He said he'd wait to make sure nothing got left behind, said Thulium.
Don't be offended, said Wang Mu.
He's just careful. I get it, said Thulium. When they got into rolling ground, and then trees, and finally, the slopes of a snow-covered mountain range, Wang Mu calculated that they had detoured so far that they were out of the tropics. The air was markedly cooler, especially near water or among trees.
They might have gone north, said Thulium.
We had to choose a direction, said Peter. And if we need to go back to where we started, we don't have to do it in baby steps.
They began to climb, and whichever of the Wiggins moved ahead, they couldn't wave. Now they had to detour back and tell the others it was safe to follow. They could all sense each other well enough that they didn't have to go by line of sight. They just knew where they needed to go. They had journeyed a significant amount of the circumference of this planet when the sun began approaching the western horizon.
At this elevation, the baby will get cold, said Thulium.
Oh, we'll go back to Lusitania and sleep in our beds tonight, said Peter. We're not insane.
Wang Mu laughed lightly at Thulium's consternation. We won't spend a night here, Thulium, until we know it's safe.
Snakes, said Peter. Scorpions.
Surely when the colonists got here, they didn't release such dangerous earth creatures, said Thulium.
We don't know the native life here. Lions hunting by night are a danger in Africa. We don't know if there are native creatures here to which we look like prey, said Peter.
I don't believe Jane would have established colonies on worlds with dangerous predators, said Thulium.
She had no time to explore any of them, said Peter. Beyond ascertaining they had a breathable atmosphere, plenty of water, lots of photosynthesizing plant life on land, and were inside the Goldilocks climate zone.
That was already kind of a lot, said Wang Mu.
And the colonists were armed, said Peter. Plus, they had formix with them.
And we don't, said Thulium. Baby Fedze likes sleeping on his mattress in his bassinet in an air-conditioned house, said Wang Mu.
And so do I, said Thulium, laughing. I wasn't criticizing your plan, I was just surprised by it.
The sound of fluttering wings interrupted them. There was still plenty of sunlight, and they could pick up the bright colors of the Kias flying toward them, only a dozen or so. They whirled chaotically around the human party and skimmed just over the baby as if deciding what it was. A Kia perched on Wang Mu's shoulder.
Good evening, Royal Mother of the West.
Are we near your home forest? Asked Peter.
You've been in it for your last three jumps, said Royal Sun. But I was far off to the east, where it's already nearly night, and it took time for them to find me and tell me you were here.
By far off, do you mean, Peter began.
Oh, not far for people who can travel between worlds, said Royal Sun. But a half hour's journey for us.
Wang Mu interrupted the technical questions with the matters that seemed more important to her. Royal Sun, we want you to meet our son, Fedze.
Royal Sun said,
I must change my name now, for there really is a Royal Sun in your family.
Treat this baby as your brother, said Wang Mu, and keep your name. Fedze is blood of my blood, but you were my son before he was. Royal Sun nuzzled her neck with his head and beak. And we brought a girl to help us care for Fedze. Her name is Thulium.
We saw her, said Royal Sun. She came with Sprout and stayed long enough for us to play with her a while. But then she left and didn't come back.
I was afraid, said Thulium. And I was angry. The Kias had taken all my equipment.
We didn't take your eyes and ears and fingers and feet, said Royal Sun. But I understand. I'm glad to know your name. And you'll notice that you are not being played with today. This visit is far too important for us to want to be annoying.
Can we come back tomorrow, when we have the whole day to visit your people? Asked Wang Mu.
That is a fine idea, said Royal Sun. Many will gather from our farthest reaches.
Is this world a good place for you? Asked Peter.
All our adult females have had at least one brood, and some have had as many as three.
So there's plenty to eat, said Peter.
Not for you, said Royal Sun. You'd have to visit the human colony on the other continent, where we don't go.
Are the seeds and fruits here nourishing to you? Asked Peter.
Jane told us that she chose only worlds with compatible proteins in the biosphere when considering where to send us.
Jane thinks of everything, said Thulium.
No, said Royal Sun, because she doesn't know everything. But she knows many things, and thinks of many things, and her actions are always intended to benefit us.
Wang Mu chose to speak again. Royal Sun, would the other Kias care about meeting little Fedze? Or would he be boring, since he can't play?
You freed us from the domination of the folk below, said Royal Sun. We didn't know how much we longed for freedom until you came and spoke to us, Royal Mother of the West.
What about the ravens? Asked Thulium. There are ravens on this continent too, aren't there?
Yes, child who can vanish, said Royal Sun. There are several who are kind enough to condescend to talk to mere Kias.
Thulium laughed. Oh, come now, you surely don't think of yourselves as inferior to ravens. Royal Sun laughed too.
Ah, sarcasm, said Royal Sun. That's a game we're very good at.
Another bird, this one standing amid the grass, said in a voice only a little less clear than Royal Sun's,
We are no longer subject to the laws of the Raven Council, said the bird. We are thus twice liberated.
Wang Mu thought this was unfortunate, because she wasn't at all sure the Kias were capable of rational self-government. But since humans weren't either, she supposed the Kias would have to learn how to work things out with each other and with the ravens. It was not her responsibility.
Should we come back to this spot? Asked Peter. In the morning?
This is the best place, said Royal Sun. Because you know and we know where it is.
And the ground is level, said Thulium, so if you put the baby in the grass, he won't roll downhill.
We take our leave of you, said Peter.
We rejoice to see you now and tomorrow, said Wang Mu. It was nice to meet you, said Thulium. Thanks for not pooping on me.
Royal Sun laughed as he flew down from Wang Mu's shoulder.
Now? Peter asked.
Ready, Thulium? Asked Wang Mu. Thulium's answer was to disappear, along with the backpack. A moment later, back in the Wigan home, Wang Mu was pleased to see that Thulium had already begun preparing for the pre-bedtime diaper change.
Poor Feizhe got more sun than he's ever had before in his life, said Wang Mu, stripping off his clothes.
He was never in full sun, said Thulium. I was watching, and I don't think he got a sunburn at all.
Humans need sunlight to be healthy, said Wang Mu. You were very good with Feizhe today, Thulium. Thank you.
Thulium said nothing, but Wang Mu could see that she was pleased. Over the next week, Wang Mu and Peter, with Thulium, visited the Kias every day. They brought Feizhe with them only once, then left him with Ender and Mayumi and their children after that. By the end of the week, Thulium had her own friends and favorites among the Kias and had learned ways that humans could take part in some of their games. She even thought of a couple of simple-minded games that only the young Kias would play with her, but that was fine with her. She was a child too, wasn't she? When Peter announced that this was their last day of all-day visiting, Royal Sun laughed.
Yes, your visits make it hard for us to forage, and young mouths need to be fed, and we need to have food laid aside for winter. In these mountains, winter will likely be terrible, though we have plans for coping.
You were generous to give us so much time among you, said Wang Mu. Thank you all for taking me in, said Thulium.
You are now our friend in your own right, said Royal Sun. And you don't need older humans to come with you if you want to come alone.
Thank you, said Thulium. But I am still a little afraid.
I saw the vids of what happened to Sprout that time.
Ah, I will never happen to you. Remember that we felt like prisoners before, and our frolicking had madness in it. Fury. We knew Sprout had never harmed us, but we also recognized that he was of the same species as the folk underground. We tested him. But you have already passed our tests and played with us and with our children. You are welcome. You are honored. You will be treated as a guest, not a spy.
Thulium smiled and then put her arms behind her, in imitation of a posture the Kias frequently took. Then she bowed deeply, as the Kias bowed to each other. And then they were gone. Once they were home, and Thulium said goodnight to Fedza, and then went home to Carlotta's house, Wang Mu and Peter talked for a while in bed.
I can see she's adopted you as a kind of mother, said Peter. If you want her to live with us, I won't mind.
No, said Wang Mu. She would think she always has to care for Fedza. Let's make her welcome when she wants to come, and speak to her sociably, and also, when appropriate, intimately, like good friends who have shared journeys together.
I can do that, said Peter.
And so can I, said Wang Mu. I already have enough children in that bassinet in the other room to occupy my life for the next few years.
Not too many years, said Peter. I'm going to have children while I'm still young enough to get down on the ground and play with them.
Since you never had parents, said Wang Mu, how do you know that that's an important part of being a father?
Because Ender Wiggin had a childhood, and a father and mother, and so I know what a father is, and what he's supposed to be and do.
Wang Mu was happy that he was so openly speaking of the deep Andrew Wiggin memories that were attached to his Ayua. It was making him kinder and less fearful of the opinions of others. It was making him more loving to her and the baby, and to Thulium, which pleased Wang Mu for reasons she herself didn't understand, because there was no reason Thulium should have been so important to her.
It's because she needs me, and I know how to give her what she needs, thought Wang Mu. She's a hungry bird in my nest, and even though she didn't hatch from my egg, she's no brood parasite. I can nurture her, and still have plenty of time and love and attention to give to little Fedza. And I will visit my other adopted son, a Kia named Royal Sun. Not so often that he tires of my visits, but not so rarely that he feels forgotten. He needs to feel the love of a human being, so that he'll know that not all humans are evil. With any luck, the humans of his world will leave the Kia's continent alone forever. Or at least until both species have converged in their evolution enough to share the same habitat in peace.
That can happen, Wang Mu told herself, though she could think of no examples in history where species had treated each other as fellow citizens, as siblings, as equal friends. As long as there's never a profitable market in Kia feathers, thought Wang Mu, they'll probably be safe.
Cincinnatus put up with the twins' delaying tactics for about half an hour. Then he picked them both up and carried them to their separate bedrooms. We want to sleep in the same room, said Lanth. I don't, said Dis. Liar, said Lanth. Cincinnatus tossed Dis into his room and closed the door, and then tossed Lanth into the other room. This isn't my room, said Lanth. It is tonight, said Cincinnatus. He palmed the doors closed so the boys couldn't open them from the inside unless the ship went into emergency mode. Peace, at last. It didn't bother him that both boys were pounding on their doors or walls with their feet. The Herodotus was tough enough to stand it. "Spare the rod and you'll spoil those boys," said a man. Since there was no other human on the ship, Cincinnatus knew at once whose voice it was. "Graf," he said, "didn't anybody purge you from the ship's computer?" "You can't actually do that," said Graf. "I am the ship's computer." "You have nothing to say that I want to hear." "Fine," said Graf. "I'll just go and talk to the boys." "Leave them alone," said Cincinnatus. "You spent your career destroying children. I'm not going to let you do your work on mine." "Did I destroy Ender Wiggin?" "Did I destroy your father?" asked Graf. "You turned them into weapons of war," said Cincinnatus. "And you've spent their childhood turning your twins into far less effective weapons, but weapons all the same." "They're naturally competitive," said Cincinnatus. "They're naturally bullies," said Graf. "I would never have admitted them to battle school." "There were bullies in battle school," said Cincinnatus. "There are bullies in every army and police force and bureaucracy in the human universe," said Graf. "But in battle school, nobody was just a bully." "You certainly have a low opinion of my children," said Cincinnatus. "I have a very high opinion of Thulium," said Graf. "Somehow, she grew up to be teachable, despite her upbringing." "Meaning that she's disloyal to her family and easily persuaded by strangers." "Sergeant," said Graf, "did you have some theory behind the way you raised your kids?" "Sergeant is the nickname my brother and sister gave to me when we were little, and I was the bossiest. They aren't here. To you, my name is Cincinnatus Delphici." "I'm glad to hear it. The great Roman general who went home and farmed after the war was over." "The giant gave us names that reflected his thoughts and feelings," said Cincinnatus. "I'm not required to live up to that name." "Cincinnatus," said Graf, "you were every bit as gifted as Carlotta and Andrew. Maybe even a little brighter. Please, don't be at war with me. Awkward, obvious flattery won't make us friends," said Cincinnatus. "There are only you and your sons on this ship," said Graf. "I spent my life studying children and how to train them. I learned many things that don't work, but also a few things that do. Now that you're having to deal with your obnoxious twins all day, every day, wouldn't you like some advice on how to tame them?" "Tame?" asked Cincinnatus. "Domesticate. Civilize. Choose your word," said Graf. "They're tamed right now." There was still loud pounding on the walls and doors of their rooms. "They sound tamed," said Graf. "They give up after a while if I ignore them," said Cincinnatus. "Do you intend to keep them with you forever?" asked Graf. "Or do you count on the government of whatever planet you release them on to incarcerate them for the crimes they're bound to commit within hours of arrival?" "Their choice." "They aren't fit to make choices," said Graf, "because you haven't prepared them to make any. Did you raise them? Do you raise them? So they can live a life of crime?" "That wasn't my plan," said Cincinnatus. "And unlike you, I'm not at all sure that's what I've done." "You know that's exactly what you've done and are still doing," said Graf. "And you could do it better?" asked Cincinnatus. "I can't do it at all, since I can't pick them up and throw them into a room and lock the door behind them." "You can lock the door," said Cincinnatus. "Should I unlock it and let them out?" asked Graf. Cincinnatus sighed wearily. "Please. Please don't." "You don't like your children," said Graf. "I don't like children," said Cincinnatus. "But I love Thulium." You were hurt to learn that she resented you and wanted to be free of you. I couldn't disagree with her decision, said Cincinnatus. I still don't know if she was trying to get away from me or from her brothers. I think both, said Graf. Cincinnatus, you don't want to listen to my voice, and you'll automatically want to reject any suggestions I make. But I can give you an article to read every morning that will give you some ideas about how to civilize the boys and turn them into something that a woman might one day want to marry and a business manager might someday want to hire. Cincinnatus laughed. Where is the planet of fools where such women and such managers live? Will you read the articles I give you? Asked Graf. I'll read the first page of the first article, said Cincinnatus. Then I'll decide whether to read on. Good, said Graf. You're a sim. Why do you care? The grandchildren of Julian Delphici are a precious commodity, not to be wasted because their father is still so angry and resentful toward his father that he has never functioned as a father himself. Cincinnatus laughed dryly. You've got me all sussed out. Yes, said Graf. That's what your brother and sister both believe about you. They never said so, said Cincinnatus. They didn't dare because of your mean streak. Mean streak? Graf waved a hand. All right, your vicious streak. Cincinnatus thought of the twins, how awful they had been to Thulium, and really, everyone, including their mother when they met her. Cincinnatus also thought of how Andrew and Carlotta avoided him and said as little as possible, behavior that had begun back when he tried to convince them to kill the giant because he used up too much of the ship's resources. Just because he faced hard realities and they... I need some counsel, said Cincinnatus. The giant wasn't much of a father. All talk, mostly talk about science. He didn't have the freedom of movement to dandle you on his knee, said Graf. He filled the hold of the ship, but he lived only for you and your sibs. He loved you. He gave up his life with his wife and normal children in order to keep you alive long enough for a cure to be found for the side effects of Anton's key. That was his sacrifice. Now what will you sacrifice to save your broken children? Cincinnatus wanted to shut down the ship's computer to eliminate this ghost. But that would kill them all. So he wouldn't do it because the boys were precious to him. And they were broken. And maybe Graf's shadow would be able to help fix them. Thank you for your help, said Cincinnatus. Thank you for giving me a chance to be of service, said Graf. How did you get to be Minister of Colonization back in the day? Asked Cincinnatus. You don't sound like much of a politician. First, I tell the truth to power, whether they like it or not, said Graf. Second, I make alliances and networks everywhere so I can get around the clowns who try to thwart me. And third, I won the Third Formic War.
Oh, yes.
That, said Cincinnatus. By using your father and Ender Wiggin as my puppets, said Graf. And will you make me your puppet now? Asked Cincinnatus. No, said Graf. I don't want puppets on the Herodotus.
What do you want? Asked Cincinnatus.
A family, said Graf. My family, said Cincinnatus. If you use your head and your heart, yes, it will become a family, and the family will be yours. Not yours, said Cincinnatus. I know what I am, said Graf. The ghost in the machine, said Cincinnatus. No, said Graf. I'm just the machine. You don't believe that, said Cincinnatus. You think you're still a person. I'm not insane, said Graf. Here's what I think. I believe that you are still a person. Prove me right. I don't care what you think I am, said Cincinnatus. Help me to be a father, and that'll be enough.
Sprout led Blue into the clearing and then started beating on a hollow log with two sticks. Should I do it too? Asked Blue. He's coming, said Sprout. You're calling him? I'm calling everybody who wants a tail, said Sprout. In a few moments, the rustling of the leaves announced the arrival of people from every direction. Most of them were young Yachachiruna, though there were also several ravens. The Yachachiruna wore breech clouts now, which Sprout was grateful for. He was naturally modest himself and appreciated their concession to his feelings. Rukyak arrived last because, as he had once told Sprout, it wasn't worth coming if there wasn't going to be an audience. But he had also said that Sprout and whoever he wanted to bring would always be audience enough for him. Rukyak had met Blue before, but now he sized up the boy with a keen eye.
Aye, you hairy beast, he said to Blue. If only you had four hands instead of flat feet, you'd be courted by a good number of Yachachiruna.
Females, I hope, said Blue.
Don't hope, said Rukyak. They are never going to mate with you, because if we're still human enough to mate with people like you, we're far too human.
Blue blushed and laughed, and Sprout laughed too. The Yachachiruna of this world lived on two different continents and used boats to pass between them. One of the continents was dominated by the fast-growing human colony and the Formics and Pecaninos who dwelt alongside them. Another continent was given to ravens, whom the Yachachiruna sometimes visited. And this third continent was where the Yachachiruna mined for metals and coal and made their factories on the leeward coast, where the prevailing winds would usually carry away the smoke of manufacture.
This is our Earth, Rukyak had once told Sprout. Nest was merely a training ground, where we learned our science and engineering and languages. But here we can become one nation, and then several nations, and perhaps many nations, with languages developing freely. Here we can have a history of our own.
Sprout wished that he could believe that humans and Yachachiruna would always get along and respect each other's borders, but he knew too much of history to have much real hope of it.
I have a tale, a brief tale, to begin with today, said Rukyak.
Everyone fell silent.
It's a story of two brothers who were kidnapped away from their father when they were little and raised in a metal cave for many years. But their mother was with them and taught them to be kind to each other and kind to other children trapped in the cave. The brothers were curious about the worlds where people lived under the open sky and felt sunlight and warmth on their skin in the day and grew cold in the winter. And one day they were magically taken from the cave and placed in a world where they had never been before. There were strange magical creatures there, and also there were diseases that had once threatened to kill everybody. And there was a strange kingdom full of perils, but also wonders, like talking birds and creatures who swung in trees and had hands for feet.
Sprout didn't understand why Rukyak was telling a story that was obviously about Sprout and Blue, but he could see that Blue was enthralled, so he said nothing. And besides, why would Sprout want to interfere with the master storyteller?
I wish I could tell you, Rukyak continued, that the brothers were able to slay the enemies of their people and save their family from danger, but that would be a lie. They fought alongside their comrades, and they were brave and clever. So when the victory came, they had earned their place in the triumph. But it is not the story of that war that I wish to tell. Instead, the first time the older brother visited the strange kingdom, he was set upon by some of the magical birds who tormented him and came close to slaying him. But with remarkable courage, he refused to fight with them. None of the birds came to harm at his hands, and finally they gave up trying to kill him and gave him great honor as a powerful foe who refused to flee but also refused to fight. Not one of the birds had suffered any harm from him, even though he had suffered much harm from them. So the birds led him to a feeble old wizard who had almost no magic, but who had some tales to tell. And the wizard told the older brother the story of his people and many other things about the strange magical kingdom. In time, the brothers and their friends decided to leave the magical kingdom forever, because there could never be trust and peace between them. But the older brother remembered the feeble old wizard and the birds whose respect he had earned. So when he went back to the world he had come from, he took with him all the people of the old wizard who wanted to come, and all the magical birds who wanted to come. And he gave them lands where they could be safe. And in all of this, his younger brother was in complete agreement. For when the feeble old wizard met the younger brother, he learned that the older brother had told him everything. So it was as if the younger brother was not a stranger at all. He already knew and loved the magical birds, and he already knew the feeble old wizard's stories so well he could tell them all himself. That is why, whenever the brothers visited the lands they had given to the birds and the wizard, they were received as kinsmen, as providers, as fathers to the people of these lands, for they had been saved and brought out of captivity into a land rich in fruits and nuts, in seeds and insects, in soil that could grow crops and rocks where metals could be mined. Everything was owed to these brothers, and songs were sung about them in all the languages of the birds. The end.
The other Yachachiruna gave the grunting sounds that were their version of applause, and the ravens also made approving sounds.
What did you think of my story? Asked Rukyak.
I think you gave the brothers credit for far more than was in their power to do, said Sprout.
You are mistaken, said Rukyak. For if you had not listened to my story and told a believable version of it to the other travelers, we would not have been transported to the freedom and plenty we now enjoy.
Sprout gave it a little thought and realized that Rukyak was right, at least to a degree. The vids of Sprout's experience with the Kia and with Rukyak had been a vital part of the Descalada Project's understanding of the peoples of Nest. And even though it was Jane who had done all the transporting, she was responding to the desire of Sprout's heart to save his wonderful new friends from the dire enemy that had already slain so many Kias.
It was a good story, said Blue. I hope to live such a life as to make it true. Rukyak laughed at him.
How I wish you could swing through the trees with me. It's so exhilarating, like flying and yet always close to the earth, with the smells of life all around.
I wish I could too, said Blue, but I'm not foolish enough to climb a tree and try to keep up with you.
I know, said Rukyak. You would certainly fall and die or be crippled, and that would take all the pleasure out of it for me.
And for us, added Sprout.
Unless being dead is very pleasant, said Rukyak. That's a tale I can't tell, because nobody has come back to report on it.
You said this was the first story, said Sprout. Do you have another?
It's not really a tale, said Rukyak, because it's both true and not very interesting.
True stories are best, said Blue, even if they're not designed to be entertaining. Sprout was proud of his brother, now that they were both becoming men. As in the story, he was glad that the two brothers were close, so that what happened to one might as well have happened to the other. Rukyak changed branches so that now his feet were touching the ground as he sat on the branch.
I need my feet connected to the soil for this story. It's about the makers of the Yachachiruna.
About how they made you? Asked Blue.
Only at the end, said Rukyak. I must tell you why they became the people who could make us out of themselves.
A silence fell upon the clearing.
They lived among the high mountains, our ancestors, who spoke the holy languages of Quechua and Aymara. And Guarani,
murmured one of the Yachachiruna.
Keep silence, said another.
There was nobody among the Huapaya who spoke Guarani, said yet another.
Should have been, said the first.
Are we done with old and pointless disputes? Asked Rukyak.
His fellow Yachachiruna muttered apologies and fell silent.
I will call them the mountain people, said Rukyak. Nobody in the wide world knew they existed except tribes that lived in the jungles to the north and east, or along the seashore where they fished for their food. But in this isolated place, with no one to teach them, they taught themselves. There was a plant that had no real use, except that it formed little knobs of hard flesh underground. And now and then, in times of famine, some of the mountain people would dig up one of these knobs and try to eat it. It was hard to eat, and had an unpleasant flavor when they ate it raw. And if they washed it before boiling it or roasting it, the people who ate it became very sick. They learned that they could roast it and eat it as long as they left the dirt on the skin of the knobs, for the dirt apparently contained the antidote for the poisons. They became so skilled with the preparation of these little knobby roots that the knobs became an important source of food for the mountain people even when there was no famine. They began to plant them and nurture them, and by choosing which of the knobs to replant and nurture, they made the roots more delicious and less poisonous. This shows that already the mountain people understood how to genetically alter a living thing by selective breeding, and they didn't confine this skill to the potatoes which became their gift to the whole world. There was another plant related to the potato vine that produced tiny red berries that were tart and sweet and delicious. The berries could be collected together and crushed and boiled to make a sauce, and the mountain people began to breed them to give more and more berries, and bigger ones. The cultivation of these berries became widespread, and when they reached another people far to the north, they carried the breeding even farther, because these people did understand breeding, but they did not realize that there is a time to stop making changes. This is why they took a perfectly fine little cereal grain and bred it larger and larger until the grain grew into huge cobs covered with massive grains. The yield per hectare of ground was great, and by drying and grinding these huge grains, they could feed large populations in every season. So they were very pleased with themselves. But when they got their hands on the berries that the mountain people had bred, they did the same ridiculous thing. They grew the berries to be big, fat fruits, and all the delicacy and beauty was gone. The mountain people, though, remembered to keep all things in proportion. The desert people from the north gave the world maize, and it was a good gift, ugly as the giant cobs had become. The mountain people gave the world potatoes, the most complete and nutritious crop ever grown on earth. And both peoples created tomatoes. The mountain people made them sweet and juicy. The desert people made them huge. Did the world thank the mountain people? Of course not. They were enslaved and oppressed. But they kept alive the heart of the mountains, and when the day came that they could go out into space, they became once again great miners and hewers and builders. And they also became great breeders, though now they chose to be breeders of birds. Some of them had befriended and studied ravens and kias, because they were the smartest of all birds, smarter than any of the other animals that humans had worked with. The huapaya kept breeding them carefully to be smarter and smarter, until the ravens understood human speech and grasped the way the humans were breeding them. At that point, when the huapaya fled the realms of Earth to escape an invading enemy, the ravens took over their own breeding, until all the ravens could understand human speech, and many could speak it. They learned to operate machines that the humans made for them, until at last the ravens, and to a degree the kias, became sentient beings, equal partners with the humans, equally entitled to freedom and prosperity, equally capable of acting cooperatively to improve everyone's lives. But in the spaceship, the mountain people did as the ravens did. They bred themselves. They had enough science to alter their own genes directly, so they could create a race of humans who no longer had flat feet, but could grasp with four hands and swing through null-gravity environments and grip both tools and the pipes and beams that they clung to. These new people were trained as engineers, repairing the spaceship, making new parts, inventing new machines, improving everyone's life. They were not human anymore by then. They had the minds of humans, the desires, the memories, the lore of humans, but they could not interbreed without losing the improvements they had been given. When they reached the planet Nest, they could swing through trees and travel much faster than the regular folk, and the Yachachiruna befriended the clever birds and proved that they could all live together in harmony. Sprout had already heard a version of this story,
but the surrounding Yachachiruna seemed to hear it as their own epic.
"We are the heirs of the mountain people," said Rukyak. "We control our own evolution as the ravens do. We satisfy our own desires as the chaos do. We build machines better than any other humans and invent whatever we need. Some day, just as all humans now cultivate and eat potatoes, all humans will come to us for machines. And in the meantime, we will breed ourselves into ever greater perfection. We are the mountain people."
And among the listeners, there came a chant, "Yachachiruna! Yachachiruna!" Even the ravens joined in. When silence returned, Rukyak spoke in a normal voice to Sprout and Blue.
"I know, Sprout, that I told you a version of this story before, but without the story of our heritage in genetic science, your people are great geneticists, but so are we."
Sprout waited, but Rukyak said no more. Then he understood what he was being asked. "Rukyak," said Sprout, "friend of my heart, you are genetic scientists at heart, whether you do it by modifying genes or by selective breeding. My family also altered our own genes to rid ourselves of a defect and to enhance our intelligence. We also separated ourselves from the rest of our species, though Blue's and my existence shows that we can still interbreed with regular humans."
"Our stories, then, are very different, but also very similar," said Rukyak.
"Would the Yachachiruna wish to learn what my people know of genetic science?" asked Sprout. "Perhaps we can all grow wiser by pooling our knowledge." Rukyak bowed his head gravely.
"Sharing knowledge is a sacred thing, and if you teach us, you will lose the advantages you have over us, because you know so many things that we don't know."
"Will you use the knowledge we share to make war against us?" asked Sprout.
"I say that we will not," said Rukyak, "but I am only one. Likewise, you say that you would share, but you are only two."
"We are only two brothers," said Sprout, "but we are both superb students of genetic science. We too know enough in our own minds to teach you everything that is now known in the hundred worlds and among the leguminids and the hiberas."
"You truly know all of that?"
"We know how to access all of it, and we understand all the principles," said Blue. "This is not empty boasting. We are young, but we're pretty amazing." Rukyak laughed.
"That is the most modest bragging I have ever heard, and the most boastful modesty."
"Confer with your people," said Sprout. "If they agree to vow never to make war against flat-footed humans using the genetic knowledge we will pass on to you, then we will spend as long as it takes, coming to you frequently to teach and to answer questions, while you also teach us from your lore and wisdom." Soon the gathering dispersed. Bidding a fond farewell to Rukyak and acknowledging and saluting Yachachiruna and ravens alike, Sprout and Blue returned home to their mother's house. Blue took both of Sprout's hands in his.
"What have we done, Brussels?"
"We will continue the work of Prometheus," said Sprout.
"And if the gods send an eagle to devour our livers," said Blue, "the ravens and Kias will swarm them and mob them and drive them away."
"Why shouldn't the sentient species all share what they have?" asked Sprout.
"You notice they didn't ask us to share the secret of detouring," said Blue.
Jane wants that ability to die with the people who now know how to do it. The power of going anywhere instantly is more than any person should have, said Sprout. Except us? So far, we're using it fairly and wisely, to the benefit of all, said Sprout. We think, then, that we're superior to all the peoples we aren't giving this power to? Asked Blue. We have the power, said Sprout, and we try to do no harm, but it would be better if no such power existed. When we're gone, it won't exist anymore. Until it's discovered again, said Blue. But that won't be our problem, and it won't be our fault, said Sprout. Because we'll be dead, said Blue. The dead commit no sins, said Sprout. Then they went into the kitchen and annoyed their mother by snitching food that she was still in the midst of preparing. You boys, she said, driving them out of the kitchen with a spoon. Don't you know that we're the heroes of the people? Asked Blue. Yes, I do know that, Mother replied, but that doesn't mean you aren't still brats. Then, on impulse, Sprout grabbed his brother and half-dragged him back into the kitchen. There the two of them hugged their mother tightly and refused to let go. How can I cook if you crush me like this? She demanded. At the same time, though, she hugged them back fiercely. Thank you, Mother, said Sprout. For what? For choosing to bring us into this amazing universe, said Sprout, and for giving us minds capable of understanding the blessing we've been given. Blue laughed. What he said, he murmured. On balance, said Mother, it's worked out pretty well so far. Now get out of the kitchen and let me finish. Your father and Thulium will be here soon, and I want to be able to serve as soon as they arrive. We are heroes of a story, said Blue. Rukyak said so. And he's no fool, said Mother. They each snitched one more bit of a couple of different things, but they knew their mother was only pretending to be angry, because she was proud that they liked her cooking well enough to want an early taste. As Sprout lay in bed that night, wishing he could sleep, but knowing it would be a while before he managed it, he wondered if the right thing for him to do would be to stop using the power to detour and merely live within the limitations of normal life. And he also wondered if he should take Rukyak aside and try to teach him how to detour, so that the power would be given to him to take his people somewhere else. If the need arose, I will take neither course, he decided. I will use this power in benign ways that meet my needs and don't harm anybody else. But I'll obey Jane and teach it to no one, not even my own children, if I ever marry and have babies. I won't teach it to Blue, even though I know he would use the power wisely and well. Because power is worthless without boundaries and the self-control to respect them. Then he thought of all the amazing things that were bound to happen in the future, and he felt a stab of regret that even if he lived to be old, he would only see a tiny portion of the future and would die before anything ended, because it would never end.